Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review and author of The Weed Agency. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for you today, as usual. And we start with the good. Just yesterday, Jim, you and I were talking about the new NBC poll, which was a generic poll suggesting that the population is trending Republican heading into the final weeks of the midterm election campaign. Now the much-celebrated number-crunching guru Nate Silver of 538.com says he gives Republicans about a 60% chance to reclaim majority of the Senate. They would need six seats to do that. He also included a handy odds chart of every Senate race, many of which, of course, are considered foregone conclusions at this point. But in the middle, he's got good odds for Republicans to pick up, as we've long suspected. South Dakota, West Virginia, Montana is almost a lock now, thanks to the plagiarism scandal of Senator Walsh. He's got Tom Cotton, 60-40, up on Mark Pryor. Those are odds. Those are not polling numbers. The two that are deadlocked at 50-50 are Alaska and North Carolina, and Republicans still have some work to do in hopes of picking up states like Iowa, Colorado, and Michigan. Bad news if you're Scott Brown. He's got it 90-10, likely that Jeanne Shaheen gets reelected. But overall, he says odds are looking decent that Republicans can take the majority, and that's obviously goal number one this year.
It kind of says something about how much we crave the specificity of this, whether or not it actually makes sense. Like the idea of Shaheen being, she favored, sure, she's had a pretty decent lead in most of the polls. But Scott Brown's obviously, pretty close to a top-tier challenger who's already shown that he can win under unexpected circumstances, like against Martha Coakley back in 2010. A couple of numbers did jump out at me. Like, if I said to you, Greg, that Dick Durbin is more likely to be defeated than Mark Warner in Virginia. Now, it's 97% for Warner and 95% for Durbin, and we can kind of roll our eyes at the specificity of that exactly 2% there. But look, overall, very little of what's in this latest assessment from Nate Silver is that surprising. I think it says that things have been pretty stable throughout the summer, and the headline sums it up well. Republicans remain slightly favored to take control of the Senate. Now, if you're on the right and you are saying, okay, I can put my feet up on the desk and take it easy, we got this thing in the bag, then you're a fool. Because if there's anything Republicans have demonstrated, it's a proud tradition of finding new and innovative ways to grab defeat from the jaws of victory. But look, this is a circumstance in which it's a fairly good set of circumstances for Republicans. They obviously have a bunch of seats that look like they're in their grasp or close to being in their grasp, and a whole bunch of other ones where they have a decent shot. So we'll see what happens. No one should be letting up around now in terms of their efforts or activism or, getting out the vote efforts and things like that. The outlook remains good. And obviously, since, Nate Silver is really worshipped as a demigod in most liberal circles because he told, Democrats what they wanted to hear in 2008, 2012, this will send a shiver down their spine, and all of a sudden they'll insist that he's a crazy alchemist who doesn't know what the heck he's talking about.
Probably right. All right. Well, from that mirth, on to the latest bad news out of Afghanistan. This is from the New York Times. A United States Army major general was killed on Tuesday by an Afghan soldier shot at close range at a military training academy on the outskirts of Kabul. An official of the American-led coalition and Afghan media reported Tuesday. The officer was the highest-ranking member of the American military to die in hostilities in the Afghanistan war. And Jim, as you and I have documented many times, it hardly gets any coverage anymore, even though the casualty rates are quite a bit higher over the last few years than they were in the first few years of this conflict. It seems like everybody's just ready to get out of there. And when you hear stories like this, not only is it another tragedy, you wonder if it's a tragedy that's even remotely contributing to the possibility of a stable Afghanistan 20 minutes after we leave.
I think the pessimism is warranted. And as folks who've been reading Campaign Spot know, I've been looking at a lot of the reports of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, a lot of money that appears to not be being used as effectively as it could. And ironically, you really don't put this on our military, our State Department, USAID, or even the contractors. In most of the cases, with certain exceptions, the Americans who are going to Afghanistan are doing their jobs about as well as you can possibly expect under some very difficult circumstances. The problem is the Afghans have a very divided culture and government. Nobody trusts Karzai. Corruption is rampant. And as a result of and there's not enough kind of a chicken and egg problem that because of a lack of security, you can't do all these reconstruction projects are basically falling apart or not working the way they're supposed to or not having the impact they were hoping for. And because of all that, the efforts to win over the Afghan people isn't working. And obviously the security situation isn't working. When the last U.S. troop is home from Afghanistan, we're going to have a very difficult conversation in this country about whether it's possible for the U.S. to really, we can win on the battlefield. We can win militarily. What we are finding exceptionally difficult going all the way back to Panama, probably, is the idea of being able to leave a stable, functioning government in our wake when we leave. And if, as I suspect, you look at this, a lot of this stems from Afghan culture and this kind of, you know, tribal loyalties and this inability to work for the good for the entire country instead of helping out your brother or your cousin or somebody like that, similar to what we've seen in Iraq where the Iraqi army fell apart. What can the U.S. do when the problems of these other countries and dangerous parts of the world stem from culture? If we cannot change the cultures of this place, I don't think anybody would argue that changing the culture of another country is an exceptionally hard thing to do, short of, say, dropping two atomic bombs on them and you know, getting their absolute surrender. Anyway, big mess in Afghanistan. The news is grim, further grim today. We may have a really thorny conundrum facing us in the years to come, which is that we have dangerous parts of the world that we can go in and we can, you know, our military is quite simply the best in the world. But unless you can build something stable afterwards, you're probably going to be ending up with the same problem again within a couple of years. And that's increasingly sad to say, looking like what we're going to be dealing with in Afghanistan.
Very discouraging, to say the least. On to the crazy martini now. And, of course, the immigration debate raging hot and heavy in Washington at the end of last week. It was a big deal on the Sunday morning chat shows and even into the early part of this week. One of the comments that was made over the weekend was by Ron Fournier of the National Journal on one of the Sunday morning shows, and he essentially said that right now the fastest growing voting bloc in America, Latinos, believes that the Republican Party hates them, and if Republicans don't do something about that, well, this could be the last year that they actually have a chance of doing well in national elections. Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks was on the Laura Ingraham show yesterday and was asked to respond to that comment. Here's what he said.
This is a part of the war on whites that's being launched by the Democratic Party. And the way in which they're launching this war is by claiming that whites hate everybody else. It's a part of the strategy that Barack Obama implemented in 2008, continued in 2012, where he divides us all on race, on sex, greed, envy, class warfare, all those kinds of things. Well, that's not true. Every single demographic group is hurt by falling wages and lost jobs. And so the Democrats, they have to demagogue on this and try to turn it into a racial issue, which is an emotional issue rather than a thoughtful issue. If it becomes a thoughtful issue, then we win and we win big.
So, Jim, I think most conservatives would agree that the president tends to divide people, particularly during campaign seasons. But the one thing the national media and Democrats are going to run with is that this guy thinks there's a war on whites and everything else will get lost, and that doesn't help.
There's actually, you know, parts of that statement actually were nowhere near as incendiary and insensible as the headlines would suggest. But the moment you say war on whites, well, there's your headline. People will say, you know, like, as if, you know, Mo Brooks, you know, congressman is playing the victim card. And what better way to, you know, sow discord between groups of people than to make it sound like somehow you're, you know, you're the victim there. It is frustrating because I think it was Josh Trevino, who used to contribute over at Red State, made an argument about whether the conservative movement was going to be about ideas. And you can go back to Hayek, you can go back to Burke, you can go back to all these kind of philosophical ideas that were looking at society as a whole, or whether the conservative movement was going to become identity politics for white people. And I think it's sad to say there are times where, you know, certain, you know, activists, certain folks have had no problem dipping into those waters and sounding like really their ultimate problem is, you know, those people over there are the problem. And look, you know, I'm as staunch control the borders guy as anybody. I'm one of those guys who wants to see every illegal immigrant at least identified, and we figure out whether this is somebody who's a dangerous criminal and should be tossed out of the country. But there are times where the rhetoric can get overheated and sound bad. And when you say, oh, it's part of a war on whites, you know, like you know, by attempting to refute the race card, you end up playing the race card yourself. I think it's just too easily misconstrued, too easily misused by the opposition. And I just kind of wish the congressman could choose his words more carefully and a little more thoughtfully, rather than add to the incendiary nature of these kinds of debates.
Because he just talked about thoughtful versus an emotional debate. And if you give that kind of ammunition, you're not going to get to the thoughtful part for at least a few more weeks if that gets picked up in a major way. So,
one final note, and it's something that goes on both sides, but I think our the folks on the left are a little more prone to this. Anytime you see the word lawmaker in a headline, and it's something about them saying something controversial, generally it's because you've never heard of that person. So, you know, there are enough state lawmakers, there are enough city officials and things like that in the United States who say wrongheaded or stupid things. Who are then immediately seized on by the opposition to say, aha, this congressman you've never heard of. And let's face it, most Americans have never heard of Mo Brooks before yesterday, and they will not remember him past tomorrow. Then suddenly get used as a sort of representative sample of what the opposition is all about. So it's a cheap, easy game that the opposition has gotten really good at, and people should at least be aware of this kind of discussion as we see. You know, my guess is this will be probably the most common line of attack in the coming months.
Mm. Choose the words carefully. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.